Right, well, thank you for that introduction. If you've ever looked at more than a handful of depictions of prehistoric animals, you will have noticed that you tend to see the kind of similar kinds of images being depicted again and again. We tend to see very samey-looking animals being repeatedly depicted, often in the same poses, proportions, often with the same integument, often even with the same colour schemes. We can call these perpetuating sets of images paleo art memes. A meme is an idea or piece of behaviour that passes from one person to another. A meme is kind of like the cultural version of a gene. And in recent years, the idea has really caught on that images of prehistoric animals, particularly those in the popular literature, are plagued by a non-trivial amount of copying, repetition, and meme perpetuation. Having just mentioned copying, I won't be talking about plagiarism. It is an important issue. And let's get one other thing out of the way at the start, this being that there's nothing wrong with the perpetuation of these paleo art memes. There's nothing wrong with being inspired by existing imagery when creating images of your own. There's nothing wrong with basing your work on that of your predecessors. They may have done the detailed, tedious anatomical work that you need to use when depicting a given extinct organism. So memes are not inherently bad. I'm not saying they are. And one more kind of preambly thing to say, there's an increasing amount of postmodernism in paleo art today, which means that we are seeing a number of homages to the work of predecessors. Here's one of my favourite examples. So some things that look like meme perpetuation are deliberate homages. Now, in this talk, I do want to discuss paleo art memes in general, but I also think that analysis of paleo art and the memes within it has more to say than is generally recognised. Portrayals of extinct animals are often so much more than just pretty pictures. They, in many cases, encapsulate and communicate a specific hypothesis or set of hypotheses about the organism or organisms being portrayed. In fact, we can probably go as far as saying that paleo-artistic depictions frequently, in fact commonly, depict a kind of accepted, unspoken status quo, the status quo of any one particular time. They frequently encapsulate an accepted idea, even when it isn't written about. And as a consequence, they have this potential to be of great interest to people interested in the history of paleontology, those interested in the evolution of ideas about life and past, and those interested in how paleontological facts, hypotheses, ideas have been conveyed and portrayed to the public. And we'll look at some very specific case studies of this in a minute. So there are three main themes that I will cover in the rest of, or aim to cover, in the rest of this talk. First of all, I really want to show you that paleo art memes are a thing. This isn't just some idea that I came up with. The pervasive repetition of imagery, design, composition, and details is real and quite easy to document. Secondly, I think that specific case studies demonstrate that paleo art memes, indeed paleo artistic images in general, are important and useful, as goes the history of paleontology. And thirdly, on a somewhat less positive note, paleo art memes also show how many artists depicting ancient animals are sometimes uninformed. They are sometimes failing or unable to find access or obtain the information they need. It is not, however, the fault of those artists. So is it true that memes abound in the world of paleo art? Let's look at some of my favourite examples. Various popular books of the 1970s, 80s, and 90s depicted this animal. It's become known as the freaky giraffoid Barosaurus. Now, these are all renditions of the late Jurassic North American sauropod Barosaurus, and they all show it in the same way. It's always shown as being proportionally short-tailed. It's shown as having a strikingly erect, thick-based, muscular neck that's often bulging with veins. The upper part of the neck is shown in this inverted U, and along the ventral midline of the neck there's a rafe and a frill. A rafe is a soft tissue ridge formed by the fusion of two distinct embryological halves. This is a really weird way of depicting Barosaurus, especially given that we know well that Barosaurus is a diplodocid. It's a close relative of Diplodocus, so it is a long-necked, long-tailed sauropod with a whiplash tail tip. Here's Scott Hartman's accurate skeletal reconstruction of this dinosaur. So where did this freaky giraffoid version come from? Well, if we trace its various iterations through the literature, we see the oldest of them being this really very nice illustration by Bernard Robinson, first published in 1975. Now, at this time, the only available life reconstruction of Barosaurus was this famous, brilliant drawing by iconoclastic American paleontologist Robert Bakker, This drawing was first published in 1968, and it was then republished in numerous popular articles, technical journal articles, and books throughout the 1970s. Looked at today, it's obvious why Bakker's Barosaurus is so... why his Barosaurus is so odd. The animal at the front there is shown in kind of three-quarters view. It's foreshortened. It's not meant to be short-tailed at all. Notice also that Bakker has chosen to give these animals really erect mast-like necks. And he's also shown the animals moving at speed. I wouldn't say they're running, but they're definitely speed walking. I think what happened is that Bakker's illustration was the prototype for Robinson's illustration, and Robinson's was then the prototype for all the other freaky Barosauruses that came thereafter. And this short-tailed freaky giraffoid meme then persisted until 1995. Here it was depicted by the brilliant Czech paleo artist Zdeněk Burian. Note in particular the look of the trees between Burian and Robinson's versions. So not only is this a really excellent example of meme perpetuation in paleo art, I think it also shows well the fact that the artists producing these images were struggling and in fact failing to find accurately proportioned good reconstructions of Barosaurus that they could rely on instead. Now, all of these freaky giraffoid Barosauruses appeared in books where qualified paleontologists were supposedly providing consultancy. So why did nobody actually step in and give the artists the information they obviously needed? Well, hold that thought. Let's move to another paleo art meme, the black and white Forus rhacus. Forus rhacus is a giant predatory flightless bird from the Miocene of Argentina, and it has repeatedly been depicted with this really striking black and white livery. Now, we are pretty much all in agreement that Forus rhacus is a close relative of the living Seriamus. And on the basis of this information, we might predict that Forus rhacus was probably brown, it may have had barred plumage, may have had dark wingtips. But instead, what seems to have happened is that Zdeněk Burian opted to depict Forus rhacus in this classic black and white vision. He gave it a distinctive neck ruff, and he also gave it a very prominent sear. That's a large kind of soft tissue structure present around the nostrils in some living birds. And it's thought that Burian based this view of Forus rhacus on an earlier drawing by the great pioneer of paleo art, the American Charles Knight. And Knight produced this drawing, which shows the bird in black, white, and grey. It was always argued by the late, great Dan Varner that Knight's Forus rhacus was based on secretary birds. And if you look at the legs in particular, I think that does seem to be likely. But do we really know that Knight meant his Forus rhacus to be black, white, and grey? I don't know if you can make it out, but it kind of partially coloured some of that illustration, but he never finished it. So we don't know what colour he really meant his bird to be. He may even have meant it to be brown, we just don't know. Note also that Knight started this meme of giving Forus rhacus a shaggy tail like that of an emu, cassowary, or rhea. Now that's not impossible, but again, we would expect, again, based on the living relatives of this bird, we would expect that it more likely had a rectricial fan, so it had a fan-like arrangement of large veined tail feathers. Anyway, Burian really kind of locked in the black and white emu-tailed meme, and we then see this perpetuated in artwork all the way up to modern times. It's an interesting colour scheme. It's certainly not an implausible one. It is obviously somewhat reminiscent of male ostriches, but the point is that this look for the animal isn't the one that we should prefer or favour based on what we actually know about Forus rhacus and birds of this kind. Now, I could say really similar things about another famous extinct flightless bird, that being Gastornis or Diatryma. The name Gastornis goes to the European species of this kind of bird. The name Diatryma goes to the North American ones. Increasingly, workers think they're probably the same genus, in which case the name Gastornis has priority. Whatever, the meme here is for this bird to be depicted as ratite-like, to be shown as having this dark, shaggy, cassowary-like plumage. In contrast to Forus rhacus, Gastornis slash Diatryma is from the Eocene. It's about 40 million years old, and it was a forest-dwelling mega herbivore. There was a time when it was thought to be an apex predator, which is why you have these reconstructions of it eating small horses. So this shaggy, feathered, cassowary-like meme was in part based on the discovery of filaments that were actually thought to be feathers. However, the meme persisted long after those filaments were actually shown to be plant fragments and not feathers at all, and the meme also persisted long after it was determined that Gastornis slash Diatryma is a galloanserine. It's a member of the bird lineage that includes gallinaceous birds like pheasants and partridges and quails and such, and seriforms, wildfowl, waterfowl, ducks, geese and swans. And on the basis of that information, well, we should expect Gastornis slash Diatryma to have distinct remiges, so large veined wing feathers, distinct rectrices, large veined tail feathers, and it should have non-shaggy body feathers as well. There is now some fossil support for this contention. Let's look at what's probably my favourite paleoart meme, the demonic Quetzalcoatlus. Quetzalcoatlus, you probably know, it's a long-jawed, long-necked, toothless Asdarchid pterosaur from the late Cretaceous of North America. Now, as championed by Mark Whitten and myself and various other researchers, we've argued that these animals probably look something like giant quadrupedal storks, at least when grounded. However, there was a time when Quetzalcoatlus was imagined to look very different. From about 1975 onwards, it was depicted as some kind of vision of hell. It was shown as having a short, toothy skull with a rounded, bony nubbin at the back. It was shown as being like some kind of vision from a Hieronymus Bosch painting. It's clearly meant to make a living by absorbing the souls of baby dinosaurs. And in keeping with this demonic meme, it was always shown as being, nearly always shown as being red. From where did this meme originate? Well, from this one illustration, produced by Italian artist Giovanni Caselli, published in 1975. When asked to produce a reconstruction of Quetzalcoatlus for a popular book, that being Beverly Housted's The Ecology and Evolution of the Dinosaurs, Caselli was given no reference whatsoever and literally invented a hypothetical giant pterosaur. And this then ended up, it then took on a life of its own. And this demonic Quetzalcoatlus meme persisted until 1999 before disappearing from the literature. Today it's been replaced by images which instead show Quetzalcoatlus in this excellent terrestrial stalking meme, which again, this is Mark Whitten and myself first started talking about it in 2007, we published it in 2008, and this has now become a meme too. We see repetition of the same aspects of design composition, the same details. You'll notice in particular these animals like to eat baby sauropods. And here I'll make one of my favourite jokes and say that the best of these reconstructions is the one down there at the bottom right. There are, in fact, probably, well, definitely tens and probably hundreds of these paleoart memes out there. I could talk about them for hours. Let's just look very briefly at a few others. There's the bird-grabbing Ornitholestes meme, the louse-like Scolosaurus meme, the green and blue naked-fingered Archaeopteryx meme, the speckly blue and white walking with dinosaurs Liopleurodon meme. I can tell you Tim Haynes is quite happy about the fact that one's become a meme. And just in case you've gotten the impression that this is only a thing that affects Mesozoic animals and fossil birds, it isn't. This is the stripy megawolf Andrewsarchus meme, now very inaccurate in view of what we think about the appearance of Andrewsarchus. This is the monarch of the Glen Megaloceros meme, in which Megaloceros is always made to look like a red deer stag, something we've long known to be quite inaccurate. And I should also mention the vulturine Pteratornis meme, in which Pteratornis is always made to look like Buzz Buzzard from the Woody Woodpecker cartoons. So hopefully I've convinced you that paleoart memes are a thing. So let's move to my second contention, and this is that paleoart memes have the potential to tell us interesting things about paleontology itself. Now, it seems quite easy to say that these perpetuating sets of images don't reflect anything more than the fact that artists copy each other, and that all we're seeing is people copying their predecessors. Obviously, that is true for a great many of the cases concerned, but for others, this is too much of a simplification because they actually tell us interesting things about the science behind the art, about the interaction between art and science. And I propose that paleoart memes depict this unspoken status quo. In 2001, paleontologist and anatomist Larry Whitmer argued that everyone had been putting the nostrils of sauropods in the wrong place. The bony nostrils of sauropods are located higher up on the main head, and virtually everyone had been putting the fleshy nostrils up there as well. But Whitmer argued that that was wrong. He argued that information from living reptiles combined with information from blood vessel patterns and nerve impressions in fossils actually showed that the fleshy nostrils weren't located inside the bony nostrils, they were located some distance down the snout, close to the mouth. And he presented a strong case. This idea has been more or less universally accepted since he published it. That is not Jar Jar Binks. That is actually meant to be a sauropod dinosaur. However, Whitmer didn't find any specific statements. He didn't actually point to any statements at all in the technical dinosaur literature where anyone had made specific comments about how and where they imagined these soft tissue nostrils to go. Our view on what was clearly a kind of community-wide meme comes predominantly from artwork, not from anything written down. So this mainstream view, this like consensus opinion on a specific anatomical hypothesis had been presented predominantly via artwork and not via statements in technical literature. There are several other good examples of this. They concern such things as feathering in Archaeopteryx and early birds. The Mosasaur's frill, that's a brilliant example, I don't have time to talk about it. The sail of Dimetrodon, the look of the stem whale Pachycetus, and facial anatomy in stem whales like Bacillosaurus and Dorudon. It's not true that all hypotheses about life appearance have lacked adequate discussion in the literature. Such topics as trunk anatomy in Amabilodontids, that's a sort of shovel tuskers like Pentavelodon, facial appearance of saber-toothed cats, and body shape and limb posture in Desmostylians, these have been the subject of technical discussions that have involved a marriage between art and science, but they are exceptions. Not only can we say that artistic portrayals, as conveyed through memes, are the portrayals of the mainstream, they frequently depict the hypotheses that are accepted and endorsed by the mainstream, they very frequently are actually the only representations of those favoured hypotheses. So that's why I say they depict this unspoken status quo. Is it possible that paleo art memes are even more important than this? Could it be that images as conveyed through memes influence scientific thought and could they therefore feed back into the science? Well, I had a go at counting how plate function in Stegosaurus was depicted in artwork, and then I wanted to see how that matched with written statements. And I haven't finished it. But at the moment, my thinking is that paleo art memes do influence popular and community-wide perception. So they affect the way given issues are covered in popular books. They affect the opinions of non-specialists, like, say, children. But I'm not sure how influential any of this is, as goes scientific hypotheses. I mean, if you're like an expert on a given group of animals, you are supposed to build your knowledge from the ground up. You're not supposed to base it on a groundswell of popular opinion. You're not supposed to base it on popular artwork. So what explains meme perpetuation in paleo art? Why? What do we learn about the popularization of paleontology from these case studies? Well, one of the main reasons that paleo art memes have been so pervasive and continuous is that this sounds mean, but bear with me. A substantial number of the artists who perpetuated memes haven't really known much about the subject matter. They've assumed that a given anatomical configuration, a given skin texture, most bizarrely, a given colour scheme, is the one that you should use. A strong case can be made that originality in paleo art correlates strongly with level of expertise. So if you don't use or support paleo artists who strive to do things properly, you're not going to see original or accurate product that really matches our rapidly evolving understanding of fossil evidence. Now this sounds a bit mean and accusatory, as I've said, but it's reflective of the way that one industry in particular functions, and that industry is the one that churns out popular books, particularly for children, popular encyclopedias, popular natural history books, part works. The artists who generally produce the images for these books, these products, are not specialists or experts. They're in-house generalists who get asked to do everything. They're not paid very well for their efforts, and they often work to impossible deadlines. I've got an insider perspective on this. I was involved in virtually all the books you see there in the upper right. And there isn't really much that we can do to really change the way this industry works. The one thing we can do is that help the people that produce these images help their access to better resources. We want it so that when they Google Velociraptor, they see less of this and and more of this. And this is something that's happening slowly, and some of us involved, some of us here today are part of this movement. But also deeply relevant is the fact that much of paleo art meme perpetuation concerns cases where relevant experts actually fail to step in and provide the artists the information that they need. They fail to correct the mistakes. And this is a somewhat sensitive issue because it does hinge on the attitudes and behaviour of individual scientists, and consequently it's difficult to discuss. So to wrap up, paleo art memes, they are a pervasive, significant aspect of paleo art history. They have been important, as goes how images of extinct animals are presented to scientists and the public. The fact that memes reproduce the mainstream wisdom of the time is important because it means that there's this unspoken status quo that's often reflected in art. This in turn means that we can get a unique insight into the ideas of those scientists who worked with the artists in many cases. However, in many cases, memes are perpetuated because artists are copying their predecessors and because those artists lack the ability or expertise to create novel reconstructions of their own. Once you exclude deliberate homages, memes can work as red flags. They can show either that an artist had to resort to copying or that they weren't given relevant primary data by the expert who was supposedly employed to help them. And all of that connects to this general message which Mark Whitten and John Conway, myself and others have promoted, which is that we should support good, accurate, innovative paleo art that strives to give us something new and involves an appropriate level of expertise and research. Thank you very much.